Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Ali Abonima. We continue our reporting on the student intifada emerging and growing across the world, demanding that university administrations and lawmakers stop facilitating and funding the genocide in Palestine. Here in the U.S., state violence against students and faculty has been deployed and encouraged by university officials intent on destroying the movement. But activists engaged in the anti-genocide encampments are undeterred and are helping expose the deep ties between the academy and Western settler colonialism, Zionism, and imperialism. To help us understand the movement and its historical context is Barbara Ransby, a scholar, writer, and longtime activist. She's the John D. MacArthur University Chair and Distinguished Professor in the Departments of Black Studies, Gender and Women's Studies, and History at the University of Illinois Chicago, and is also the author of several books, including Ella Baker and the Black Freedom Movement, A Radical Democratic Vision, and Making All Black Lives Matter, Reimagining Freedom in the 21st Century. Dr. Ransby, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Nora.
Let's start by having you talk about your overall reaction to the student intifada sweeping not just across the U.S. in the belly of the beast, but across the world as young people specifically rise up against Israeli genocide and apartheid. How are you watching what's happening?
Well, I mean, I have two reactions. One is to be very inspired and awestruck by the courage, the moral courage of these young people. I mean, in a way, young people are doing what political leaders don't have the moral courage to do, you know, speaking truth to power, speaking out about what's happening in Gaza, the absolute unconscionable genocide and ethnic cleansing that's going on in Gaza right now. And some of them are new to the issue. Some of them have been involved for a while. And I think, you know, the encampments, I visited the encampment at University of Chicago and have talked to colleagues on many campuses across the country through Scholars for Social Justice, which I'm a part of. The culture inside the encampment is important because it's not only are they speaking out on this question, but they're also finding ways to speak to and educate each other, to bolster each other's courage, to build community, to make decisions together, you know, including Jewish students and groups like Jewish Voice for Peace have participated and talked through with Arab and Muslim students and Palestinian students, you know, how they've come to this issue and why it's important for them to speak out. So I've been very inspired and very proud of many of the students. I've also been very fearful for them because, as you know, the violent reaction and the violent suppression of these peaceful protests has been just utterly outrageous. And it served to bolster, you know, the determination of a lot of the organizers. I think while some of the encampments have been shut down, I don't think that that commitment that those young people had has been shut down. And in some ways, their eyes have been opened even wider of how important this issue is and how extreme measures elites will take to enforce silence around it. So I've been fearful for them, but I've been very proud of them, very inspired by them, and very disturbed by the reaction of institutions and the level of violence. And, you know, UCLA was a horrible example of outside vigilantes being allowed to rain violence down upon unarmed students and students who were trained in nonviolent de-escalation tactics who were very vulnerable. So I feel angry about that. And I feel like we have to take these threats very seriously as well. Sari Makdisi had a very detailed article in the LA Review of Books, you know, just documenting what that attack in UCLA was about. But I don't think we should let the attacks overshadow the positive aspects of these protests. The fact that they happened, the fact that they were sustained, the fact that students on campus after campus, you know, rose up once one encampment was shut down, I think should give us inspiration.
Barbara, if I may, we go back quite a few years, and thank you for joining us. And you were part of the anti-apartheid student movement in the 1980s, specifically at Columbia University, which, of course, has been sort of ground zero for a lot of the protest and repression. Talk about that movement and the parallels and differences you see in the student movement for Palestinian liberation today. And I'll just add on a personal note, I've said this before, I came to the United States to university in the late 80s at sort of the height of the anti-apartheid movement. And I remember there were encampments, there were occupations, and not just to do with South Africa, but also regarding Nicaragua and CIA recruitment and military recruitment on campus. And I don't remember this kind of repression ever. What can you reflect in terms of your own experience and some of the differences or similarities you see in the movement now, as well as the reaction?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just say it is good to be in conversation with you again. You know, I respect the work that you do very much. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, there was Central America solidarity work. There was a sanctuary movement both when I was an undergraduate at Columbia and then as a graduate student in Ann Arbor at University of Michigan. That movement happened parallel to the Free South Africa movement. And yes, we did. We built shanties to symbolize the dire conditions under which Black South Africans lived at that time in subpar housing. We didn't have as large, the kind of large encampments that exist now. But you're right, there wasn't the same kind of repression. In fact, in the 1980s, when we had a blockade of Hamilton Hall at Columbia, it was a year after I graduated, but it was my friends and comrades who led that action. Police weren't brought on campus. Students weren't dragged off. They weren't physically attacked. But let's be clear, there were consequences. Students were brought up on disciplinary charges. I think it's a question of the degree. And it's a different moment. I mean, you know, I'm a historian by training, and we always want to draw historical parallels. But it was a very different moment. I think we had already started to see the tide turn in South Africa in terms of people no longer being able to deny the moral injustice of the apartheid regime there. In Israel, and in contrast, I think there's a whole scale denial and a deliberate skewing of the historical narrative, a deliberate skewing of the contemporary reality, and folks with vested interests in perpetuating that distortion. Of course, also politicians are in the pockets of groups like AIPAC, which are lobbying very, very hard for the truth about what's happening in Gaza not to be told and it not to be reflected in policy. So we're up against all of that. There wasn't that same kind of South African lobby. But the other thing I'll say is not only were there parallels, but there were intersections. Omar Barghouti and myself and Tanakil Jones, who was one of the leaders of that struggle, recently wrote a piece in The Guardian. And many of us who were Black student activists learned about Palestine through Palestinian fellow students who were studying in this country at the time. Omar was at Columbia when I was at Columbia. We learned through our ANC comrades. We learned directly from Palestinian students and deepened our understanding and our commitment, you know, at that moment. So there are parallels and there's also intersections.
Mm-hmm.
Nora. No. Just if I can follow up on some of that. And I had not known, of course, I knew that Omar Barghouti, who is one of the leaders and founders of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, I knew that he was at Columbia, but I didn't know that connection that you had. And that's really wonderful to learn because it really shows how people in different struggles learn from each other and build solidarity together. I was listening to the Chapo Trap House podcast the other day, and they had an interview with a former administrator at two universities where these protests have been taken place. This person had worked at both of them. They didn't name them, and his identity was masked and his voice was masked because of the fear of retaliation. So sort of a whistleblower. Mm-hmm. And one thing he said that really struck me, I thought it was such a good analogy. He said that these universities are essentially, I mean, it's an observation others have made, before they're educational institutions, they are real estate development companies, mm-hmm. invested in billions of dollars, mm-hmm. and they're also hedge funds, because they all, as particularly the Ivy Leagues and the big private universities, have endowments that are billions or tens of billions of dollars. So he said that from the perspective of trustees and administrators, students demanding divestment is the same as, they would view it as the same as if you went to the corporate headquarters of McDonald's and demanded they stop making hamburgers. Yeah. I mean, is that the right way to understand? And the reason I bring that up is because when we go back to South Africa, everyone wants to project backwards that, oh, yes, of course, we were all on board with the anti-apartheid struggle. But the fact that students had to protest for divestment reminds us that the universities were against it. They were invested in apartheid South Africa. So can anything ever change? I mean,
well, yes. and to start with your last statement, you know, one lives long enough, and of course, there's all kinds of reasons to be disillusioned. But I will say, as a student, as a young person fighting for justice in South Africa, I really didn't think the South Africans would win. I didn't think in my lifetime apartheid would. It seemed so powerful. It seemed so formidable. And it seemed so profitable, right? So there were lots of investments in that mineral-rich country. And I thought, they're never going to give it up. You know, they're never going to give it up. But it did. And sadly, you know, our dream of a egalitarian South Africa did not come to fruition. But which I think is still an ongoing challenge and thought about, you know, Palestine and why your, you know, your book of many years ago, which you and I had some lively discussions about when it came out, but of course you're right, is what comes next, you know, like what, when we stop bad things from happening, when we displace, regimes that are oppressing us, like what comes next? So that's to start your question. But yes, the university has become increasingly corporate since the 1980s, right? With neoliberalism around the globe, the university has become a site of corporate power. I always cringe when administrators talk about our students, you know, young people trying to understand the world and find their place in it as clients and customers. I find it obscene. Okay. That's also a part of a corporate mentality. And when it comes to university investments, I mean, I work at a public institution, but at large private institutions, they have huge endowments and, you know, they're deemed nonprofits, so they don't pay taxes the way a corporation would, but they have huge endowments and huge economic interests that they covet. My colleague Devarian Baldwin has written a book about universities and how they become gentrifiers and landlords. And of course, Columbia has a notorious reputation for being a gentrifier and landlord in Harlem and Morningside Heights. So this is the 21st century university. And I think reclaiming higher education is a real challenge for progressive forces. We saw decades of efforts to democratize higher education, of opening the doors, of trying to make it more affordable and so forth. And now we see a huge backlash, both in terms of the repression of student dissent, but also in terms of the attack on Black studies and queer studies, you know, in universities around the country.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm reminded that Manoush Shafiq, the president of Colombia, was an IMF, International Monetary Fund, official for a long time. And that's not a coincidence, right. Of course.
And she behaves just like a corporate manager, not a principled educator.
That's right. Absolutely. On that note, what we've seen in the last few weeks is the most extreme violence against students by university administrations and governments since the movement opposing the American war on Vietnam. In 1968, Columbia itself notoriously called the NYPD on its students, and there were massacres of students by the National Guard and the police at Kent State in Ohio and Jackson State in Mississippi, both in May of 1970. Why do you think the crackdown now is so much more violent than anything we've seen since that era?
Well, I mean, all the reasons that we've been saying. I mean, it's, you know, we know that among progressive and left forces, you know, the issue of Palestine has been a issue that many progressives have sought to avoid. The students are not allowing that to happen. And in some ways, you know, the violence of Netanyahu has gone so far, is so extreme. You know, like, how can a person of any integrity not speak out? So the fact that students are forcing this issue, that so many of the, you know, educational elites and their trustees and politicians, financial backers, you know, have tried to avoid, you know, it's the substance of the issue, I think. And it's also the time. I mean, we have to say everything happens in a context, nothing happens in a void. And so we see growing authoritarianism in general. We see growing authoritarianism from, you know, from the right wing, from the MAGA movement. We see growing authoritarianism around the world. And so I think this is an extension of that, and a kind of dress rehearsal, if you will. And we should indeed take it very seriously. So, you know, I mentioned UCLA a minute ago, where you were asking me about the students, the attacks on the students. But it's also opened the eyes of faculty on these campuses, not just UCLA. A dear colleague of mine at Dartmouth, who was arrested and banned from the campus, you know, Annalise Orlick, faculty members at Emory, one faculty member who I think wasn't really involved, was just passing by and watched the students being attacked and arrested and questioned what was going on. She says, I'm like, you can't do this. And they threw her to the ground, knocked her glasses off, and arrested her. So even to witness, to dare to speak out and witness injustice, forget about organizing around it, you know, has engendered this harsh, repressive, violent response. So I think it's the substance of the issue, and I think it's the context of the times.
This same podcast that I listened to with this administrator, this whistleblowing administrator, made another point that really made me think, which was he pointed out how a lot of people, you know, were thinking back and saying, oh, what if they call in the National Guard, you know, thinking back to Kent State or Jackson State. And he made the point that today the police in most cities are far more militarized than the National Guard. Absolutely. So you don't need the National Guard, because when you look at those heavily armed riot police, sometimes they're wearing military helmets and military camouflage. The National Guard's equipment would pale in significance to them. And I just thought that was a very important point to make, that this is also an accumulation of the decades of overspending on yeah. policing as the only thing we want to spend money on.
Right. But can I just speak to that for a minute, Ali?
For sure, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this was evident in Ferguson when the police used heavy military equipment to repress the uprising around racist police violence in Ferguson. And it's also evidence in the current campaign, another example of repression and looming authoritarianism in the Stop Cop City movement in Atlanta, where a young Central American protester who came into the work from a position of an environmental justice activist was killed by police protesting against the usurping of a forest outside of Atlanta to make this mock city where police could come and train it for military type interventions. So it's a very dangerous turn, and we are seeing it's giving us, if we don't already have it, an analytical framework that connects the dots between so many issues that people have been struggling around in justice movements for the last several decades.
And of course, it connects, and activists against Cop City are making the connection that for many years, we've seen very close links between major police forces in the United States and Israel. Indeed, Israel, that's a selling point. They say, we have the expertise. We know how to do this stuff. So they implicitly liken Palestinians living under occupation to predominantly black populations living in American urban centers that are the usual targets of this violent over policing. So those connections, I think, are very important. But I want to come back to, so you mentioned the violence against faculty, which is again something that has shocked people. And I want to ask you to talk more about the position of faculty who have also been facing, and in fact, in some ways, have been facing for a lot longer, extreme repression, particularly Palestinian faculty. We saw recently, for example, Columbia University President Minush Shafik denouncing three members of her own faculty before a McCarthyite congressional committee last month. One of them, Professor Joseph Massad, has faced a national campaign of vilification and efforts to get him fired for more than 20 years. And in 2014, during the last major Israeli massacre in Gaza, which now seems to pale compared with the scale of the genocide we see now, Stephen Salaita was fired by the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign for criticizing Israel. What effect does this have on faculty generally? Do you think faculty are doing enough to support one another? And do you see more organizing going on between faculty and students as a result of this repression?
Absolutely, I do. I mean, in some ways, the mask gets taken off in these kinds of moments. I mean, you know, the Stephen Salaita case, which was at my institution, was absolutely inexcusable. I mean, as you know, Stephen Salaita tweeted something, you know, on his own time, and was, you know, just his career was ruined as a result of this. But no, I do think that in some ways, faculty, especially senior tenured faculty, kind of feel like they're in a bubble, and they're realizing that tenure doesn't protect you from state violence. Tenure doesn't protect you from repressive university administrators. So I think people are kind of having their eyes open. And this reminds me too of a parallel to some of my organizing experience at Columbia, because I was a student senator, which sounds more important than it was, as we so quickly learned. The faculty and students had a joint senate, and it was supposed to, you know, be a democratic gesture, you know, on the campus, that we would make advisory decisions to the administration. Well, we had a unanimous, I was a senator, introduced a divestment bill, got unanimous support, and then the administration and the trustees completely walked it back. We had more support after that because many faculty realized the facade of faculty governance or campus democracy. And I think in this moment, when faculty see just by inquiring what's happening to their students, just by standing with and standing up for their students, that they are vulnerable, it is, I'm sure, making some people fearful. Of course it would, but also making some people outraged and, you know, and willing to learn more about the underlying issue, but also stand up for the principal, even if they're not in full agreement on the issue. Mm-hmm. And we've seen Columbia has a large network. And, you know, quite frankly, people who I didn't think necessarily would be taking this position in this moment have pleasantly surprised me and impressed me. And they also developed a broad network of support for students because, as you know, Shafik not only kowtowed and capitulated and did just a song and dance before these right-wing Republicans in Congress who were so ignorant of the issue, they couldn't even formulate coherent questions. And she was in no way made even a gesture at correcting inaccuracies. But what also happened was, you know, students were evicted, given 24 hours to leave their dorms, who had been arrested on campus, peacefully protesting. And faculty developed a network to make sure that they were able to get food and housing and be taken care of when the university essentially put them on the street with no meal cards, no way to take care of themselves, you know, for simply standing up for what they believe in, which ostensibly we should be training young people to do.
Right. Yeah, it's what do you make of the, I mean, just absolutely incredible, like moral principles that these students are engaging with and you know, and employing. I mean, it's really remarkable to see these students who, you know, especially those who get accepted into these elite universities, Columbia, UCLA, Harvard, MIT, University of Chicago, that are saying, you know, the level of repression and suppression and threats that the administration is levying against the student movement is meant to intimidate and create, you know, an atmosphere of fear within the student body so that they, you know, they then prioritize, you know, getting this elite education over their activism. But students aren't taking the bait. And we see over and over again, these students and members of faculty, you know, especially like, as you said, those who aren't even tenured, really taking a stand and saying this degree from this, you know, fancy institution is not worth more than Palestinian children. And it's really kind of like calling the university's bluff in a way, like, you know, you think you can intimidate us into silence. It's not working. How do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, that is what the message is. You can't intimidate us into silence. But I think it's also a triumph over a certain kind of cynical individualism, because they're feeling collective power and the ways in which they have supported each other. And the caricature of this movement, you know, the big charge against this movement has been they're anti-Semitic or they're jeopardizing the safety of the campus, you know, and it's just utter lies. I mean, there have been principled discussions within these spaces, young people, you know, exhibiting enormous kindness to one another. And again, I have to say Jewish students and non-Jewish students, because the audacity of administrators attempting to speak for those Jewish students who are a part of the encampments, insisting that they, you know, that all Jewish students feel afraid. So that sense of collectivity that students have found, the sense of collective power, the notion that we are bigger when we are together, that we are stronger when we are together, we're smarter when we're together, that's a real triumph over kind of neoliberal rank individualism. Make it on your own, you know, be cutthroat, do whatever you have to get to the top and look out only for yourself. I mean, that's part of the message too, of this sort of careerist ambition. And so to risk both personal safety, but also personal well-being and in terms of career, you know, is admirable. And for young people to be making that decision, often young people are in the forefront of struggles like this. And sometimes people say it's because they have less to lose. You know, they're not taking care of others. They're not parents yet, if that's what they're going to do and all this. But I really think it's more than that. I think that there is still an idealism about the world among many young people, that some older people maintain that idealism too. I try to hold on to it. But you know, believing that they can make a difference in the world and fighting for that right to do that, you know, is part of what we see. But, you know, just the compelling, I mean, you know, one of the things in talking so much about the students that we've been, some of my colleagues and I have been talking about, we also don't want to lose track of or lose sight of what they're fighting against, what they're outraged by. I mean, I can tell you, I'm not someone that cries easily, but I have actually shed tears just looking at the New York Times images. You know, forget about Al Jazeera and Democracy Now and Electronic Intifada and other, you know, bolder, more truth-telling alternative publications. But looking at just the images that the mainstream media put out about Gaza, it's like this is a crime against humanity, a genocide happening in real time right in front of us. And, you know, if the world doesn't speak out against this, if young people don't stand their ground, you know, what comes next? I mean, where is this going to end, and what will we tolerate if we tolerate this? So, you know, I admire them in the abstract that they're standing up for what they believe, but also what they're standing up and speaking out against is what we all need to stand up and speak out against.
If I can just say, I really take your point about a sort of a cynical individualism, which is part of neoliberalism, that you are not a student who's part of a body, part of a collective, but you're a customer who's coming to get credentials and skills that you're then going to sell in the marketplace for your own benefit. And so these students are also challenging that. But I wonder if it's something even broader and deeper in the sense that we are all going through what you're talking about, Barbara. I mean, we don't know how to cope with what we're seeing. We don't know how to cope with what we're hearing from our friends and our colleagues in Gaza. We don't know what to say to them. Words are inadequate. Whatever we do feels inadequate. And I think that something like this, on this scale, with this ferocity for 8 months of just relentless slaughter and the coldness with which our so-called leaders support it, spin it, just, you know, ignore it, I think I wonder if it has just exposed a rot that no institution, none of the institutions that we're supposed to believe in that are supposed to work, none of them work the way they're supposed to. And I wonder if there is a bigger ferment, you know, if this is sort of, I'm not sure what the right word is. Yes, the focus is Palestine and stopping this genocide right now. It has to be. But I wonder if this is also exposing bigger fissures in our society, a bigger crisis that is even deeper.
Yeah. I mean, I think there is an existential crisis, and and, you know, as someone who studies the past, right, there are all kinds of inflection points in the past. All kinds of pivots after which things are never the same again. And I think this genocide in Gaza is one of those moments. But another existential crisis is, of course, climate and the increasing denial of the climate crisis in the world. The kind of forces, the sort of unrelenting capitalist extraction mode in our society, in 21st century society, the drive of technology to extract, to exploit, to survey. I mean, the intensity of these trends, even financialization. So the book I'm working on now is looking at three things: climate justice, a climate crisis, technology, and financialization. Financialization has changed the way that profiteers make profit. In a lot of respects. And it's kind of this kind of casino capitalism, which has created a whole number of economic crises that are looming. Some we've seen glimpses of in 2008 here and around the world, but others I think are coming. So I think there are all these intersecting crises that are posing challenges for people who govern and dominate the world and creating challenges for us. What kind of future do we want to live in? What kind of future exists for us unless we make radical changes to move away from war and colonialism, to move away from extractive economies, to move away from, you know, racist imperialism. I mean, all of these are the ideological engines that have fueled the crises that we currently have. And so, you know, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Gaza is both a signal and a symbol of so much more that's wrong in the world. And what kind of movements, what kind of determination, what kind of strategies do we need both in this country and transnationally? And fortunately, I'm in probably way too many conversations. I mean, there's not a formula, but I do feel hopeful that many young organizers and even, you know, radical artists and writers and thinkers are wrestling with these questions and wrestling with the largeness of these questions. And so I have to hope that we are principled enough and smart enough and determined enough to move things in a different direction. I think we have to.
Indeed. Dr. Barbara Ransby, thank you so much for all the work that you do and have done, and being a mentor and teacher to the new generations of activists and revolutionaries in this country and beyond. Thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you both for having me, and thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you, and thank you for the wonderful conversation. You gave us a lot of food for thought.
Great. Take care.